wouldn't it be nice to know how to handle any problem in life? Wouldn't it be nice to make all the right choices in life? That would be nice too. Or to find true happiness in life. Wouldn't that be nice? Or how to navigate the storms of life. Well, God has given us a book designed just for that. The book of Proverbs is designed to give you wisdom. And that wisdom is intended to show you how to handle all the problems of life and navigate the storms of life. And it uses this unique teaching tool called a proverb. What is a proverb? A proverb is, some people call a proverb a short statement based on long experience. A short statement based on long experience. Or you could call it a crystallized statement of distilled truth. A short crystallized statement of distilled truth. A proverb. And most proverbs are given in what's called Hebrew parallelism, which is basically God's way of having you look at something with two different levels or two different angles or sometimes three or four. So notice some of these proverb styles. One is called synonymous. It's two parallel statements that teach one truth. The generous soul will be made rich, and he who waters will also be watered himself. So you've got two parallel statements, but they're teaching one thing. There's also contrasting proverbs, two contrasting statements that teach one truth. He who keeps instruction is in the way of life, but he who refuses correction goes astray. You might recognize that from the reading Tommy gave in Proverbs chapter 10. And if you noticed in that reading, the Proverbs is always contrasting wise and foolish, wise and foolish. And it does this through this Hebrew parallelism. Some are comparative, two truths with a common denominator. Whoever hides hatred has lying lips, and whoever spreads slander is a fool. So you've got two different aspects of truth, but they have a common denominator. And there's also progressive proverbs, two different lines that complete one another. So one statement is an incomplete thought, and then it's completed by the next statement. Listen to counsel and receive instruction, that you may be wise in your latter days. The law of the wise is a fountain of life, to turn one away from the snares of death. So another style of proverb, a thought and then completed by a second thought. And then analogy, consequences, and characterization. So an analogy would be two lines that use an illustration to emphasize a truth. Whoever has no rule over his spirit is like a city broken down without walls. So there's a lot of proverbs that use an analogy, maybe in the form of a parable, something from nature. Consequences, cause and effect. A lying tongue hates those who are crushed by it, and a flattering mouth works ruin. So you've got cause and effect proverbs. You know, do this and it's going to cause that. And then characterization, classifying people, actions, and behavior. How long, you simple ones, will you love simplicity? For scorners delight in their scorning, and fools hate knowledge. One of the best ways to study life and wisdom is character study. And so what you're going to notice in Proverbs is there's a lot of characterization, good and bad. And we learn from that, right? So, for example, we see the traits of the wise in Proverbs. The wise are known for their honesty. They're known for humility, faithfulness, moral integrity, hard work, a proper respect and honor for God. And all of that characterizes the wise. But when we look at the fools, or the foolish, the umbrella of the term foolish or fools, look at all these characters that we find in Proverbs. You've got the simple, that's kind of like the first stage of the spectrum of fool. If we're looking at fools in terms of a spectrum, stage one would be the simple. Then the fool, the scoffer, troublemaker, the stubborn, the lazy, the miser, the seducer, the scoffer, the gossip, the glutton, the drunkard, the talebearer, and the slanderer. Quite a list of characters in the book of Proverbs. Why is that? Because Proverbs isn't just showing you what wisdom is, it's showing you what wisdom is not. And it does that by contrast. That's one way we learn, by the way, is through contrast. Do this, don't do that, or cause and effect. You'll see a lot of that. And it's all for the purpose of teaching wisdom. And what you're going to see in Proverbs and in life is that the wise, they have this self-awareness that fools don't have. It's a self-awareness and a desire to self-correct and adjust course in life. So, for example, there were three brothers. True story. I read of these three brothers. They all had an alcoholic father. And this alcoholic father would often come home late, come home drunk and angry. Well, of these three brothers, the oldest brother was a teenager, so he would stand up to the father when he came home angry and drunk. And so he would deal with his dad with confrontation and anger. The middle son was probably in junior high, and he would placate his father, basically appease his father to keep the peace, you know, get dad what he wants, you know. And then the younger brother was probably grade school, and when dad came home drunk and angry, he would hide. He would avoid his dad. So these three brothers grow up. How do you think they handled problems? How do you think they handled adversity in life?
Same way.
Same way. So as the older brother got older, how did he handle problems? With angry confrontation. The middle brother, how did he handle problems? Through compromise, trying to win people over. And the younger brother, when he got older, how did he handle problems? He would avoid. He would avoid conflict. He would hide if he could and avoid conflict. And so that's no surprise. That's what they, in effect, that's what they learned. And it reminds me of a child psychologist who identified three basic temperaments of children. So, and how they respond to adversity. So some children respond to problems or adversity with anxiety and withdrawal. That's one way children deal with adversity. Some deal with adversity with aggression and assertive action. And some with optimism in an effort to succeed through being social and cordial. And those are basically three different types of way children deal with adversity. And each way works in certain situations, you see? And so it works, and so they stick with it. So what happens is, unless the parents train the child, then their natural temperament is going to dominate. And that's how they're always going to handle adversity. Unless the parents train the children to be able to handle different situations differently. For example, the anxious have to learn to be more bolder. And the bold have to learn to be more cautious. And the overly optimistic need to be more thoughtful. This is all a part of life. It's all a part of learning. Like, we have modern proverbs today. Look before you leap. Did you ever leap before you looked? Yeah, yes. And sometimes you pay for it, right? And so this is all a process of learning how to deal with life with wisdom. Life is a process of growth, in maturity, awareness, understanding. And wisdom is knowing how to respond to all different situations properly. That's a part of wisdom. And so that's a part of learning. So what we're going to do this morning is just look at character contrasts. We're going to be doing a study on the different types of characters in Proverbs that we looked at. This morning, we only have time to look at the simple. Next week, we'll look at the fool, and we'll continue on. This basically is the first stage of the fool, the simple. Chapter 1 and verse 22, how long, you simple ones, will you love simplicity? So a dictionary definition of the simple is simple, naive, pertaining to persons that are easily deceived or persuaded, showing lack of wisdom and understanding, yet having some capacity to change. The reason that's important is because these are the least hardened fools under the umbrella of fools. The simple are the least hardened, meaning there's still a chance for them to change. There's a chance for... I'm an optimistic person. I know that there's a chance for all people to change. But we have to understand that when the Bible's talking about the simple, it's not talking about somebody simple-minded, as in they're not playing with a full deck. That's not what the Bible is talking about. It's talking about a type of fool who is simply naive and lacks spiritual maturity, okay? They lack spiritual maturity. And they still have the capacity to change. They can still learn, and hopefully they will. But as you get further down the spectrum of the umbrella of fool, you're going to see there's just less and less likeliness somebody will change, although they have the capacity to, because free will is so powerful. It's something that God gave us. When we're talking about the simple, they are the least hardened fools, not fully arrogant yet, and so there's a hope that they'll change. When you consider chapter 1, verse 1, the Proverbs of Solomon, the son of David, king of Israel, to know wisdom and instruction, to perceive the words of understanding, to receive the instruction of wisdom, justice, judgment, and equity, to give prudence to the simple, to the young man, knowledge and discretion. This is what Proverbs is for. The problem is, when you go back here, how long will you simple ones, will you love simplicity? This isn't an intellectual issue, it's a moral one. They love their simplicity. Okay, they love it. That's their happy place, apparently. So this is not an intellectual deficiency, it's a moral one. That's something that we have to remember going forward. They are going to choose to stay this way, or they can choose to change, or they can choose to get worse. They are basically the most naive and gullible of all the fools. So they have a shallow, superficial understanding of the way the world works. And because of that, they believe everything they hear. Chapter 14, verse 15, the simple believes every word, but the prudent considers well his steps. So this is one of the pitfalls of being naive or gullible, the simple. They just believe everything they hear. They believe everything people tell them. And that leads to all kinds of problems, in particular because they haven't learned to think for themselves yet. Okay? The simple believes every word, but the prudent considers well his steps. The simple inherit folly, but the prudent are crowned with knowledge. What does that mean? They haven't learned to think for themselves yet, because it's so much easier to let other people do your thinking for you. It's just so much easier. And especially when it's what you want to think, and it's what you want to hear, right? So when you look at the news industry, you have to remember it's an industry. It's a production. By the time it's been produced and you're watching it, it's already pre-digested. It's not giving you raw information. It's already pre-digested. It's giving you what to think, not how to think. It's the same thing with higher education. Both of these are billion-dollar industries. Higher education isn't trying to teach you how to think anymore. It's teaching you what to think. And it's a billion-dollar industry. Same with social media. These are multi-billion-dollar industries, but they're industries, right? They're intended to get you hooked. And unfortunately, on social media now, you don't have to think. The memes are already pre-digested, you know? The thoughts are already pre-digested. And what happens is, slowly, you don't have to think for yourself anymore. You let other people do your thinking for you. And this is not anything new. Proverbs is 3,000 years old. This is not new. But the dangers are real in every generation. And so that's what's unfortunate about how young people are targeted. Why would young people be targeted by godless ideologies? Well, because they're still naive. They still they lack the understanding necessary to know how the world works. And so they believe everything they hear. So yeah, of course they're targeted. They're being targeted for that reason. But this can happen to any of us. Do you control your thoughts, or do your thoughts control you? Who's in control? Do you control your thoughts, or do your thoughts control you? This is what's called cognitive fusion. Cognitive fusion is when a person can't differentiate between what they're thinking and reality. Like, their thoughts become truth. Okay? Now, we've all experienced this. I told Lisa years ago, I'm going to go up in the mountains, and I'm going to spend a week camping out. I'm going to go hunting, opening week of deer season, and I'll come back in a week. And then, and the plan was I was going to come back down off the mountain. You know, it's like a four-hour drive. Bring her back to a cabin there just for a day or two, and then go back home. Okay, so I'm up in the mountains, and I'm way up in the High Sierras, and no one's around. It's just me, and it's getting dark, and I'm hearing all kinds of noises. And I'm hearing scratching. It's pitch black, and I'm on the edge of a cliff. I should not have parked on the edge of a cliff, but I thought it was such a great view. Anyway, this is a stick shift, so I'm in gear with the e-brake on, but still, I'm hearing this scratching, I'm hearing these noises, and pretty soon, my mind, I just couldn't stop my mind. And pretty soon, within a few hours, I'm thinking some locals are sneaking up on the truck, and they're going to try to push my truck off the cliff while I'm in it, as a prank. And maybe they don't even know I'm in the truck, but they're just gonna shove my truck off the cliff. I was up there for 3 days, and I said, "Okay, I'm coming back." So, do you see how your thoughts? If you let your thoughts get away, pretty soon, what you're thinking is reality when it's not, and this can happen to pretty much anybody in any situation, but. Just because you think something doesn't make it true. Okay? So, if you're going to believe everything people say, how naive and gullible is that? But if you're going to believe everything you think, how is that different? So, a wise person checks what they're thinking with another wise person, right? Bounce this off somebody. Is my thinking accurate on this? So, I'm thinking about, for example, King Saul. King Saul was the king of Israel, and he was the man. He was head and shoulders above everyone else. But then here comes David. And David is just this shepherd boy. But he has this faith that allows him to kill Israel's greatest enemy, Goliath, defeat the Philistines. And pretty soon people are singing David's praises more than they're singing King Saul's praises. And what did that do to King Saul? It started getting in his head. And now he's starting to hear things about King David and how great King David is. And now he's not the man that he used to be, right? Now King Saul isn't the main guy anymore. Now this young David, it just started working in his head, and pretty soon he's trying to kill David, his greatest warrior, the man who married his daughter. All because of cognitive fusion. Just because you think something doesn't make it true. What Saul should have done is worked with David, you know? But he let jealousy get in there. So what happens is the simple, because of they lack understanding, because they believe everything they hear, they're susceptible to manipulation. They can be easily impressed. So the one who states his case first seems right, until the other comes and examines him. He who answers a matter before he hears it, it is a folly and a shame to him. Boy, I've done that before. Somebody presents, you know, this is what's happened, and I give an opinion. Come to find out that what they told me wasn't even actually the whole story. And I'm already spouting off on my opinions. And I think this and I think that. Wow, I didn't even know the whole story. So what happens is, the simple, because they lack experience, they lack understanding, they are naive, they're susceptible to manipulation, and especially if it's something they want to hear, okay? So for example, King Hezekiah. You remember King Hezekiah was a good king, and he is told by God through the prophet Isaiah, get your house in order, your time is up, right? And Hezekiah has this moment where he weeps, and he prays to God, and he just asks, I need more time. And God hears his prayer, and he gives him 15 more years. He told the prophet, I'm giving you 15 more years. Go tell Hezekiah. So he gets 15 more years, okay? Well, next thing you know, these Babylonian ambassadors show up in Jerusalem. And these Babylonian ambassadors, they're in their Babylonian robes, and they go to Hezekiah, and you realize I'm paraphrasing. They go to Hezekiah, and they're like, oh, we were so worried about you. Yeah, we heard you were so sick. We heard you were going to die. Yeah, we heard. Yeah, so we just wanted to come check on you and see how you were doing. And Hezekiah was so flattered. You know, he's like, so they leave. So Isaiah goes to Hezekiah, and he says, who were those guys? Those are the Babylonian ambassadors. They were checking on me. They were really concerned about me. They were really concerned that I was so sick, and they were checking on me. And Isaiah says, really? So what did you show them? Oh, I showed them the temple. Really? And what else did you show them? All the gold. How much? All of it? And Isaiah says, they're going to be back, and they're going to come take all that gold that you showed them. And they did. But do you see how easy it was for these powerful people to cause Hezekiah to just melt with flattery? Because it's what he wanted to hear. He was susceptible to manipulation because it was what he wanted to hear. That's how it works. And so what happens is, being spiritually immature, they lack awareness of danger or consequences of selfish choices. So they're not thinking down the line of consequences of their choices. A prudent man foresees evil and hides himself, but the simple pass on and are punished. In other words, they're not thinking through to the next consequence or the next stage. Think about Lot. Lot was not wicked. Lot was not evil. He was spiritually immature. Okay? But here's the thing. He was so blessed that he's got flocks galore, so blessed that his herdsmen are arguing with Abraham's herdsmen because they're so blessed, there's too many animals, and they're fighting over the limited resources of the area. And so Abraham, being a wise person, he says, I'll give you first choice. We're not going to be able to, this is unsustainable, this, you know, the way things were going. You know, Lot's herdsmen are arguing with Abraham's herdsmen. There's conflict. Abraham's a peacemaker. So he says, I'll let you choose. Where do you want to go? So Lot's looking around, and, you know, he looks down to greener pastures, right? And the greener pastures are down in the valley with Sodom and Gomorrah. And so he goes, I want to go down there. And Abraham says, fine. That's your choice. So Lot goes down there. And he wasn't thinking about the long-term effects of what that move was going to do. This is why James says, don't just say you're going to go so-and-so. You're going to go to so-and-so town. You're going to do such-and-such this and that and that. Say, if God wills. James is basically saying, don't be like Lot. So anyway, we won't go through the whole story, but over time, Lot basically assimilates with Sodom to the point where angels have to go down there and rescue him. And you remember the whole story where God is telling Abraham that he's going to destroy this city. And Abraham's like, well, if there's 50 righteous, would you destroy it if there's 50 righteous in the city? And God says, no. Okay, well, how about 40 righteous? No, I won't do it for 40. Okay, how about 30? He gets it down to 10. If there's 10 righteous in the city, would you destroy the city? And God says, no, I won't destroy it if there's 10 righteous in the city. In the meantime, there's less than 10. And even then, angels have to extract them out of the city before it's completely destroyed by fire and brimstone. Lot wasn't thinking through. How many have stood upon those Bethel heights? Age after age has poured forth its crowds of young hearts to stand upon an exceedingly high mountain, while all the kingdoms of this world and their glory of them are spread before them. The tempter whispering just one small act, just one switch of loyalty to serving Satan rather than God, all this will be yours. And in self-confidence, eager to do the very best for themselves, prepared to pay the price for success, look toward the plains of Sodom from afar. And like Lot, they tried to make stones into bread. They cast themselves down from the mountainside for angels to catch. They knelt before the tempter, only to find his promise broken, the vision of power an illusion, while the tempter laughs and disappears, leaving you standing alone in the midst of a desolate wilderness. Countless. You could not count the number of people who fell for this, and including some of us. We thought being where the bright lights of the city were, that was going to bring us meaning and purpose and happiness, until we realized it was a trap. Wisdom sees beyond the apparent to that which is real. It sees beyond the temporary to that which is permanent. It sees beyond the physical to that which is spiritual. Wisdom does that. Without that, you're spiritually and intellectually handicapped because you're not able to see beyond what's really happening. And so what happens is, they're susceptible to manipulation, spiritually immature, lack awareness of the danger or consequences of their choices. Being selfish and shallow, they are willful and irresponsible. That's just the way it works. This is not an intellectual problem, it's a moral one. Since they would not accept my advice, and spurn my rebuke. They will eat the fruit of their ways and be filled with the fruit of their schemes. For their waywardness of the simple will kill them, and the complacency of fools will destroy them. The simple are just simply shallow and superficial, and that makes them willful and irresponsible. And as a result, they're just not morally grounded. You might think of the simple and the naive as innocent. That's typically how we think of it, right? They're simple. They're naive. They're innocent. This really is not what Proverbs is talking about. It's talking about a person who is gullible, without moral direction, so they often wander aimlessly into traps of wickedness. And you can read about that in chapter 7. He's just wandering right into a trap. And because they're not morally grounded in truth, they're being tossed to and fro, basically by every celebrity cause, every trending spiritual fad. It's just whatever way the wind is blowing, they're just going with that because they're not morally grounded in truth. Okay. Paul says that we should no longer be children, tossed to and fro and carried about with every wind of doctrine, by the trickery of men, in the cunning craftiness of deceitful plotting, but speaking the truth in love, may grow up in all things into him who is the head, Christ. What happens is, they're not morally grounded, so they're easily swept away, like when Jesus talks about the different hearts, the shallow heart would be the simple. And it just doesn't take root. The truth won't take root there. Okay? They're just too easily swept away by celebrity causes, spiritual fads. What happens is it leads to Stockholm Syndrome Christianity. Stockholm Syndrome Christianity. In 1973, two convicts robbed a bank in Stockholm, Sweden, and they took 6 hostages. They threatened the hostages' life, and they held them hostage and basically said, if we don't get out alive, we're going to kill these hostages. What happened, though, was when the hostages were finally released, they refused to testify against their captor. They refused to testify against the terrorists holding them hostage. And then they even raised money for their defense. And when they were interviewed later, they felt like the bank robbers, by saying, if you do what I say, I'm not going to kill you, they felt relieved. They started bonding with their captors because the captors weren't killing them. It's like a form of brainwashing. And so what happened was they took the side and the belief system of their captors. And this is what happens to Christians sometimes. Christians, Stockholm Syndrome Christians, are more interested in the belief system of the world than their faith in Christ. And so here's how this works. Instead of defending the truth to the world, they defend the world against the truth. And instead of being missionaries to take the gospel into the world, they're trying to bring the world, as reverse missionaries, they want to bring the world into the church. So basically, they're Stockholm Syndrome Christians. They're siding with their captors and want to side with them rather than with God and with the truth. And it's because they're naive. They're gullible. They have no moral direction, so they wander aimlessly into traps. And as a result, they're just blowing with the wind, whichever way the culture blows. We're going to put a gay pride flag in front of the church, right? Because that's the way the culture goes, right? So we're going to side with that rather than with the truth. See how that works? They're not morally grounded in truth. And so what does John say? Do not love the world or the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, the pride of life, is not of the Father, but is of the world. and the world is passing away, and the lust of it. But he who does the will of God abides forever. Some people are going to side with the world instead of with God. They're going to side with the world instead of truth. And John is saying, don't love the world or the things of it. Because all of the world that John is talking about is organized in rebellion against God. That's what this is. All of this is organized in rebellion against God. All that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, the pride of life, is all organized in rebellion against God. And it's passing away. Only those who do the will of God is going to live forever. So, there's a test that determines or identifies the wise and the foolish. And the test is in chapter 9, verse 8. Do not correct a scoffer, lest he hate you. Rebuke a wise man, and he will love you. Give instruction to a wise man, and he will be still wiser. Teach a just man, and he will increase in learning. So there's a character test here. And the character test found here in chapter 9 of Proverbs is, how do they handle correction? How do they handle correction? We all need course corrections, right, in life. Like an airplane, 1 degree off doesn't sound like much. It's only 1 degree off. But over the course of an entire flight, 1 degree off could be hundreds of miles off course. So we all need to course correct at times in our life. And the measure of one's wisdom can be seen in how they receive a rebuke or how they receive correction from truth. When we look at how the fool receives it, the fool despises wisdom and correction, hates them for it, always right in their own eyes, reacts defensively with scorn, refuses to listen, wants to drag them into an argument, leads others astray along with them, and attacks others rather than face their own failures. They don't want to course correct, okay? They're not going to listen to correction. The wise, on the other hand, will learn from correction and discipline, and they'll actually love them more for it. They'll take wisdom to heart and become even wiser. They'll seek wisdom and spend time with the wise. Instead of taking offense to criticism, they use it and learn from it. He who keeps instruction is in the way of life, but he who refuses correction goes astray. So this is what determines, one of the determining points between the wise and the foolish is, how can they receive a rebuke? How can they receive correction? One person said, those who never retract their opinions love themselves more than they love the truth. Those who never retract their opinions love themselves more than they love the truth. They're not going to change, right? Because to change would be to admit that they were off course. And we're not going to admit that. So we're just going to keep going right off the cliff. I'm thinking about Naaman. Naaman was captain of the Syrian army. You have to understand, you don't become captain of the Syrian army by being simple and naive. He was no dummy, okay? The man was the captain of the entire army. But he also had a terrible case of leprosy. And there was no cure for it. But there was this Jewish servant girl, and she says, if you would have only gone to this prophet in Israel, he could cure your leprosy. And so Naaman arranges a trip, and he goes to see this prophet in Israel. And notice what happens. Then Naaman went with his horses and chariot and stood at the door of Elisha's house. And Elisha sent a messenger to him saying, go and wash in the Jordan 7 times and your flesh will be restored to you and you shall be clean. But Naaman became furious and went away and said, indeed, I said to myself, he will surely come out to me and stand and call on the name of the Lord his God, wave his hand over the place and heal the leprosy. Are not the Abana and the Parphar, the rivers of Damascus, better than all the waters of Israel? Could I not have washed in them and be clean? So he turned and went away in a rage. It's not what he wanted to hear. First of all, the prophet didn't even come to the door to meet him. He sends a servant. Okay, that right there. You can almost hear Naaman saying, "Do you know who I am?" Elijah wouldn't even go. He sends a prophet, and he sends a servant, and he says, just tell the man, go dip in the Jordan 7 times, and he'll be cured. And Naaman gets mad. He gets angry. So he's like, wait a minute. I thought the prophet was going to do this and do that, and then this was going to happen, and then that was going to happen, and then the leprosy would be cured, you know? And it didn't happen that way. And so he's leaving. He's about to leave in anger. He's not going to come back. Thankfully, though, he has this one servant who's wise. And his servant came near and spoke to him and said, "My father, if the prophet had told you to do something great, would you not have done it? How much more then when he says to you, wash and be clean? If he told you to do some big thing, would you have done it?" Yeah, he would have done it. "Well, then what about this simple thing?" So he went down and dipped 7 times in the Jordan, according to the saying of the man of God, and his flesh was restored like the flesh of a little child, and he was clean. I really believe that God intentionally, sometimes will ask somebody to do something that doesn't make sense to them. It's a test of faith, right? It doesn't make sense, especially when the rivers back in Syria were like probably 10 times cleaner than the Jordan. It doesn't make sense. But if we would just trust and obey, we could learn something. I think Naaman learned, do not be wise in your own eyes. Fear the Lord and depart from evil. It will be health to your flesh and strength to your bones. And in that case, it was literal, health to his flesh and strength to his bones. Do not be wise in your own eyes. In other words, trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not on your own understanding. In all your ways, acknowledge him and he will direct your paths. What is that saying? Trust in your feelings? Trust in your friends? You know, trust in your emotions? Trust in the opinions of others? Trust in the media? No. Trust in the Lord with all your heart. And don't lean on your own thinking, your own cognitive fusion. In all your ways, acknowledge him, and he will direct your paths. It's actually simple, and some people might think too simple, just like Naaman thought. But you would be surprised how simple and powerful the truth really is. It is simple, it is profound, it is powerful. And that's why it goes under the radar of most people who are wise in their own eyes. If we can help in any way, please let it be known as we stand and sing.